what we do here is to not just expose the pretext about the war in against Iraq, but to unfold who are the real terrorists, what is the nature of the capitalist state, what is its compelled, driven, genocidal program for subject peoples it needs to exploit and dominate.
Now, we're going to be with you from 9 until 11:30, 2.5 solid hours of information from the Treason at the Top Premium, the excerpts that you're going to hear, as well as additional discussion that Ralph and I have prepared for you. But we want you to call now, 212-209-2950, and start it off. Do your calls while we're discussing, and that way we'll continue with the excerpts from the premium without the added interruption of our request from
yes,
you.
Because what we're really addressing here, as Maya's indicated, is the ability to continue to broadcast, the ability for a non-commercial radio station to reach out to its audience. And because it's listener-supported radio, there's no way for free speech radio to sustain itself except through the support of those who receive the information and who are our life support system at WBAI and in Pacifica, and of course for Taking AIM. Taking AIM is able to continue on the air because of the support of those who wish to hear it. And that's why we appeal to you to call in and to support the station, support WBAI's continued programming and Taking AIM in particular. All through the course of this next 2.5 hours, please keep those phones ringing.
We hope we have our Taking AIM audience with us, our listeners, our loyal listenership, and also we hope we have some people who haven't heard Taking AIM before. And I know you're going to be not only thrilled with what you're hearing, but you too will become devoted to what we're doing. Now, that doesn't sound a bit egotistical. It's because so many of you have been writing to us and telling us how much you depend on these broadcasts.
Well, what we do, after all, Maya, and I mean, it's not just a question of loyalty to Taking AIM as such. We focus on removing the mask from the capitalist state. Who are the real terrorists? What is the documented role of the documented evidence for the pretexts for war that include terror attacks sponsored by the United States intelligence agencies themselves? The false category of terror to whipsaw us into a numbed hysteria and acquiescence in long-prepared imperial design. Whether 9/11 or prior examples throughout U.S. history, we expose the real character of the capitalist state, and we attempt to demonstrate why you can't reform it, you can't hinder it, you can only overthrow it and remove it, brothers and sisters. That's our thesis, that's our theme. We provide the evidence for it, and we provide the analysis and the argument for building a movement based on the working population of this country capable of speaking truth to power and organizing to displace and remove this tiny handful of people, that 1% out of the population of the United States that owns 90% of the national wealth.
And it's at this time of the fund drives that we express our appreciation to you with special programs such as Treason at the Top. And also, we depend upon each and every one of you contacting us by email at takingaim@pacbell.net, that's PACBELL.net, or takingaim@WBAI.org, or writing to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. And participating by sending us your comments, your research that you've done, notification of articles that we might have missed, and most of all, letting us know that you share in the WBAI community. 212-209-2950. And right now, our engineer, Kidu, who came in specially to help us today, is going to start with the first part of the presentation of Treason at the Top.
Good evening. Hello, and thank you for coming tonight. My name is Doug McDonald. I'm one of the co-founders of the Solano Peace and Justice Coalition, And I'd like you to thank you for coming to tonight's forum with Ralph Shulman and Maya Schoen. Tonight's presentation is entitled Treason at the Top, The Dynamics of War and Repression at Home and Abroad, and Your Civil Rights. Ralph Shulman was Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina. He worked with Malcolm X with respect to the battle for the Congo and has negotiated the release of political prisoners in many countries. Today he is an author and investigative journalist and produces Taking Aim with co-producer Maya Schoen, heard weekly on Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York City. Maya Schoen is an economist and has a long history as an activist involved in political, community, and labor issues. Among her activities over the years, she's worked closely with both Casa Nicaragua and Casa El Salvador during the struggles taking place in Central America, was the coordinator of the Tri-County, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and San Luis Obispo Labor Party chapter, and was a founder and on the steering committee of Healthcare for All California. Again, thank you for coming and enjoy the evening. And with that, I will introduce Ralph Shulman.
Thank you very much, Doug. I want to express our appreciation to Doug McDonald and to the Solano Committee on Peace and Justice for giving us the opportunity to talk to you tonight. And I appreciate all of your coming out. I hope we'll have an exchange, a good discussion. What we want to address here is the underlying circumstances and dynamics of this but little continuation of a long-standing practice and policy of imperial plunder and devastation on the part of those who hold power in this society. I think it's important that we understand that whether we look at the war that's now devastating the poor and small country of Iraq, the impoverished people of that country that has been so afflicted by imperialism for more than 100 years, a people that lives in the countryside on 30 cents a day, those who work for public service and for the government work for $5 a month, which is 17 cents a day, a desperately poor people, a people long victimized, with a very specific history in relation to both U.S. and before British imperialism. But we in our own society have a structure of power. And I think in order for us to see the context in which these events unfold, tragic as they are, devastating as they increasingly will be, it's necessary for us to see who rules in this country, what it's about. The Department of Commerce in the United States had published statistics that show that about 2% of our population owns and controls some 90% of the national wealth. And in November of last year, the New York Times ran a piece in which that data was shown to be no longer accurate. The figure now is about 1% owning 95% of the national wealth. They average about 14 corporate directorships per person. The man who had written the book Up the Organization, Robert Townsend, who was the president of Avis and American Express, put it like this. He calculated that approximately 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the United States economy. Now, this is an extraordinary concentration of power. This is a tiny oligarchy that uses its vast control over the national wealth to capture the political process, the one big property party with two names that is financed by the same people repeatedly ad infinitum. And bear in mind, brothers and sisters, that we in our own frontiers have but 5% of the world's population. And yet, this small oligarchy, this ruling class, has command over nearly 70% of the natural resources of the world. By any standard, this is an empire. So imperialism is a specific sociological category. It's not a swear word. It's not a piece of rhetoric. It's a description, a scientific description of the structure of power in our society. And as such, this tiny ruling class requires increasingly a dependence upon arms production, addicted to that arms economy like an addict to his fix, and in ever-increasing doses. In just the past 40 years, $9.3 trillion assigned to the Pentagon. Now, that is more than the combined value of everything produced in this country taken together. Schools and roads and sewers and hospitals, everything together of productive value does not in total equate with the amount of waste production that goes through this arms economy. That is the context. That is the underlying dynamic which requires such wars of predation. As you know, the rationale for this current war against the people of Iraq is the rubric of weapons of mass destruction. In the first 41 days of the Gulf War in 1991, the United States used more tonnages and greater firepower on that country than in the total period of World War II in all theaters taken together. And that represented approximately 300 cruise and Tomahawk missiles. And these people have been telling us, these rulers of ours, that in the first 48 hours of shock and awe, they were going to visit what? Three times that amount of destruction on this small country. Every single missile, every artillery shell, every tank barrage, every bullet is coated with a substance called depleted uranium. In essence, these are tactical nuclear weapons, because when detonated, the depleted uranium, which is one of the hardest metals on Earth, is radioactive and permeates the aquifer and permeates the soil and permeates the food chain and has resulted in an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities across Iraq, as it had indeed in Yugoslavia and in the Balkans. Weapons of mass destruction. There is a very particular history about the use of biological and chemical agents, which have been long monopolized by the United States. Doug had mentioned that I had worked as the Secretary General of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina. Bertrand Russell was the honorary president, Jean-Paul Sartre, the executive president, and a wide range of people who were active politically, intellectually at the time, presided over that inquiry. We documented across Indochina the use of gases that exploded the pupil of the eye, the introduction of plague bacteria, a focus and a panoply of biological and chemical and nerve agents that the United States deployed in Indochina. And only last week, the New York Times on its front page carried a story that this current generation of children in Vietnam is suffering from an epidemic of deformities directly related to the Agent Orange and the other biological and chemical agents that have permeated the soil and the food chain and the atmosphere and have now come to wreak their havoc upon the current generation of children in Indochina. Weapons of mass destruction. A research group called BioConop obtained declassified documents from the United States government which have to do with the history of the use of germ warfare by U.S. rulers. I'm going to give a quick resume of this because I think it puts in context this entire rationale for this devastating war that's being inflicted on the people of Iraq. In 1900, U.S. doctors in the Philippines infected Filipino insurgents and prisoners with the plague. They induced beriberi in prisoners. In 1915, doctors introduced pellagra in Mississippi inmates. In 1931, the Puerto Rican cancer experiment was undertaken by Dr. Cornelius Rhodes under the auspices of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Investigation. Dr. Rhodes infected his subjects with cancer cells, and multiples died. When the experiments were disclosed, the written opinions of Rhodes were as follows. The Puerto Rican population should be eradicated, he stated, on the record. Rhodes went on to establish the United States Army biological warfare facilities in Maryland, Utah, and Panama. He was named to the United States Atomic Energy Commission, and that was the heart of radiation experiments that were carried out by the United States government on prisoners, hospital patients, and soldiers. In 1932, the Tuskegee syphilis study 200 poor black men with syphilis began a long-term experiment in which these men were to be studied. They were never told not only of their illness, but that the study itself was involved in further infecting the men themselves. The government office supervising this was the predecessor to today's Center for Disease Control. In the 1940s, in a crash program to develop drugs during World War II, doctors in the Chicago area and the U.S. federal direction infected hundreds of prisoners in Chicago with the disease. In 1950, the United States Navy sprayed clouds of infective bacteria over San Francisco. From 1950 to 1953, an array of germ warfare weapons were used against Korea. They released feathers with anthrax, fleas and mosquitoes dosed with plague and yellow fever, and rodents infected with a variety of diseases. In another series of such experiments, the United States military released clouds of gas over six United States and Canadian cities. In 1955, the Tampa Bay area of Florida experienced a sharp rise in whooping cough, including multiple deaths, after a Central Intelligence Agency test where bacteria were released from the Army's chemical and biological warfare arsenal released into the environment. From 1956 to 1958, the same phenomenon in Savannah, Georgia, and Avon Park, Florida. In 1965, a three-year study, prisoners at the Holmesburg State Prison in Philadelphia subjected to dioxin, the highly toxic chemical contaminant in Agent Orange. Lesions were neither treated, nor were the infected persons admitted to hospitals. 1966, the United States Army dispensed bacilli throughout the New York City subway system. 1968 to 1969, the Central Intelligence Agency experimented with poison in the drinking water in a number of cities across the United States. 1969, Dr. D.M. McCarter, Deputy Director of Research and Technology for the Department of Defense, appeared before the House Subcommittee on Appropriations to request further funding for projects for synthetic biological agents for which humans had not yet acquired a natural immunity. He then asked for a further $10 million to produce this agent within the next 5 to 10 years. AIDS first appeared as a public health risk 5 years after this funded activity. Richard Nixon was engaged in biological and chemical warfare agent production throughout his presidency. Ray Ravendut, the director of the Population Program of the U.S. Agency for International Development, announced the agency's goal to sterilize one quarter of the world's women. 1980-1981, detention centers in Miami and Puerto Rico with male Haitian refugees injected with chemicals and biological agents, and a condition resulting called gynecomastia, in which males developed full female breasts. 1981, over 300,000 Cubans stricken with dengue hemorrhagic fever. An investigation by the Covert Action Information Bulletin tracked the documents in which Central Intelligence Agency operatives were systematically disseminating the viral agents for their impact in Cuba. 1982, El Salvadoran trade unionists stated that epidemics of unknown diseases had cropped up in all the areas where U.S.-directed aerial bombings were taking place. 1985, dengue fever strikes Managua, Nicaragua. 1987, the Department of Defense was forced by a lawsuit by a public interest group to reveal that it was operating chemical and biological warfare programs at 127 sites in the United States. In his book, Clouds of Secrecy, Leonard Cole, public health professor at Rutgers and formerly a director of the U.S. Biological Weapons Facility at Fort Detrick, documented what the New York Times acknowledged were, quote, 239 cities and locations in the United States, unquote, where the Pentagon over a period of 40 years released clandestinely hundreds of trillions of bacilli, bacteria, fungi, and spores. In his introduction to Clouds of Secrecy, the late Senator Alan Cranston acknowledged that over 10 million American citizens were affected. These biological agents were deployed by the Pentagon in the subway system of New York, the school systems of Minneapolis and St. Louis, and specifically in the Bay Area surrounding San Francisco and environs, where spinal and brain meningitis increased by tenfold as a consequence. And yet, not a day goes by when our rulers fail to declaim that demonic terrorists are preparing to release biological agents in our water supply, our nuclear power plants, and that have spread everything from smallpox to anthrax. And I'm sure you'll recall when in the aftermath of 9/11, anthrax was being disseminated in the United States, and the established media were replete with accounts of how the spread of anthrax was indeed the consequence of terrorist activity in this country. The new scientist in London tracked the fingerprint, the DNA, the telltale characteristic of this particular anthrax, which was prepared in United States military laboratories. The fingerprint of military produced anthrax available and accessible and prepared in military labs in this country. Weapons of mass destruction.
You've been listening to Treason at the Top, the first part of the presentation by Ralph Schoenman. In this 2.5-hour 2-CD premium for the WBAI Fund Drive, yours for your donation of $100 to WBAI, 212-209-2950. We're going to continue in a little while with more of the presentation, but in order to hear the entire Treason at the Top, this is your opportunity to call 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, yes, Maya, and I want to emphasize when we talk about the need for support for Free Speech Radio, for WBAI, for Taking Aim, that the disparity between the funds that are expended by our rulers for our oppression and the money that we have available to us, all of us, for the work that we do is staggering. And I'd like to mention, too, that we tend now in the current period, particularly on Pacifica, to focus on the crimes of the Bush administration, and they're ample enough, and they are egregious enough, and they are reaching to a new level of oppression. But each administration has done that in its respective turn. And I think it's worthwhile just to mention here that at the time of the Clinton administration, the United States Census Bureau report confirmed, quote, the gap between the affluent few and everyone else has grown wider than it has been since the end of World War II. And the New York Times on June 19, 1996 stated, the indicators have shown an enormous increase in the gap between the incomes of the wealthy and those of the poor and the working class, unquote. We suffer from greater poverty, the New York Times went on to say, and deprivation under this administration than we have in this country for a half century. And the U.S. Census Bureau report revealed that in the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the share of national income claimed by the top 5% grew at a rate faster than in the previous 8 years of the Reagan administration combined. Now, what's essential to understand about this is that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are one big property party with two names. That the bureaucratic administrators of the intelligence agencies and of Wall Street and of the National Security Agency and the Council on Foreign Relations that advise them and all of the elements that define policy for the capitalist ruling class are unaltered from administration to administration. The hats they wear are from the same producers, the major banks and corporations. Let me just run this down a little bit more, because the conservative Cato Institute calculated during the Clinton years that Congress had financed 125 subsidy programs for the largest corporation at a net cost of over $100 billion per year, which did not include the tax breaks because the top 17 corporations were paying no federal income tax over a period of 10 years. Let's look at this a second. In agriculture, the agro conglomerates received $31 billion in government subsidy and $3 billion in tax rebates. The energy sector corporations were subsidized to the tune of $15 billion by the U.S. Treasury. The transportation conglomerates got $30 billion. Aerospace and high-tech got $16.7 billion in outright subsidy. In construction, the major corporations got $17.4 billion. The financial services, which is banks, broker houses, and the centers of stock and bond speculation, got $43 billion and $60 billion in tax breaks. This is during Clinton. Commodity credit subsidies were $9.81 billion. And under the Democrats, 60 cents of every tax dollar went to the Pentagon, less than 10 cents to health care, 3 cents to housing for the affluent, and none for those without, 2 cents to education, and that channeled to the schools of the affluent, and 1 cent allocated to generate employment. And during Clinton's watch, a child died of poverty every 50 minutes in the United States. 1 in 5 children went to bed hungry, cold, without heat, running water, or electricity in the rat-infested cages which pass for shelter in our inner cities. That's under the Democratic Party watch, which is hardly a pitch for the Republicans, I hope you understand. It's by way of illuminating that this is a systemic problem. This is capitalism at work. Taking aim is dedicated to illuminating that reality and preparing the resistance, because nothing short of revolutionary change and building the mass movement capable of it will transform these elements that worsen by the year and by the decade to our great detriment. That's what this programming is about. That's why it's so essential we appeal to you to sustain the programming and the radio station and the network that allows this kind of information to be brought to all of us, to arm us, to prepare us for the struggles ahead.
That's 212-209-2950, and I'd like to point out that in Treason at the Top, both Ralph and I discuss this disparity and the fact that you have one big property party with two names. It was Al Gore, if you recall, who established the reinventing government, which meant the privatization of government services and the mass firing of 200,000 workers who had unionized jobs with benefits. 212-209-2950. Treason at the Top, $100 donation to WBAI. Also, if you're a student or a low-income senior or recently unemployed, for $25, we have low-income memberships in WBAI. Call 212-209-2950 and find out all the ways that you can help contribute to keep Taking AIM and all the other wonderful programs on WBAI on the air, coming into your homes, into your cars, and into your workplace. Again, 212-209-2950. And in the coming weeks, the WBAI website, wbai.org, which has been an amazing fund of information and connections to other websites, you will be able to find the premium Treason at the Top, as well as the premiums for the other programs on the website. But meanwhile, you have to call 212-209-2950.
Right? Treason at the Top, brothers and sisters, documents the reality of capitalist rule, not only within the United States, but its history of mass destruction in victim countries across the world.
Now, to inspire you some more, to want to have Treason at the Top for your very own, and also for you to call your friends and your family and your colleagues and to tell them to come along with you so that together you can have Treason at the Top, we're going to continue with a little more of Ralph's presentation. Kiju, can you please start the CD?
When in the aftermath of 9/11, anthrax was being disseminated in the United States, and the established media were replete with accounts of how the spread of anthrax was indeed the consequence of terrorist activity in this country, The New Scientist in London tracked the fingerprint, the DNA, the telltale characteristic of this particular anthrax, which was prepared in United States military laboratories. The fingerprint of military-produced anthrax available and accessible and prepared in military labs in this country. Weapons of mass destruction. It was written in the Boston Globe that when the United States declared its intention to remove Saddam Hussein from power, and Bush gave the authorization to assassinate Saddam Hussein along with any other recalcitrant heads of state or figures in the world of which this regime in the United States would disapprove, the article in the Boston Globe stated that this had something of the air of deja vu, because in 1958 in Iraq, the Iraqi people rose against the puppet regime of Nuria Said and the infant King Faisal II. Nuria Said, known as the Stooge of Baghdad, an instrument of British imperialism. And in the enormous popular uprising that occurred across Iraq, it brought to power a nationalist officer named Abdul Karim Qasim, who not only legalized the Iraqi Communist Party and the nationalist parties of Iraq, but confined the access of oil corporations to 0.1% of the area of Iraq. And from that moment, as the Boston Globe acknowledges, the Central Intelligence Agency prepared for the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim. Indeed, the person who was directing that was the station chief of the Central Intelligence Agency in Baghdad. There's a book called Ropes of Sand by Wilbur Eveland, who was with that station, who disclosed that a young 24-year-old leader of the right-wing faction of the Ba'ath Party and a Central Intelligence Agency asset was assigned the task of the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim. And on his third attempt, he was successful. That man was Saddam Hussein. And he's been their man in Baghdad for 27 years. And with the overthrow of the government of Abdul Karim Qasim, Saddam Hussein, on the Central Intelligence Agency direction, was put in charge of what was called the Palace of the End. And tens of thousands of professors and students and trade union leaders and peasant figures and people who had been part of the national movement in Iraq were tortured, murdered, and disappeared. A bloodbath. It's not merely that Saddam Hussein was the operative. It's that he was run by the CIA station in Baghdad. And what was at work here was but the little continuation of what had occurred in Tehran, in Iran, in 1953, when the national revolution in Iran led to the coming to power of Mossadegh, who nationalized the oil in Iran. And that indeed brought about the Central Intelligence Agency putsch, which overthrew the government of Mossadegh in Iran and led to the creation of the Savak under the direction of the Mossad, the Israeli Mossad, and the Central Intelligence Agency. One of the most pervasive and deadly of secret police. The human toll at the hands of the Savak numbers in the multiple hundreds of thousands in the course of the reign of the Shah installed by the United States in 1953. In Iran. Well, brothers and sisters, every single administration in the United States since 1964 has had operational plans for the seizure, direct seizure of oil in the Arab East. It has been a permanent feature of the operational planning of the ruling class in this country. And they've not been shy about articulating what it is that they had in mind. They described the area of the Arab littoral in the Gulf, including Mesopotamia, Iraq, as a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. They made plans in each administration, and in the course of making those plans, they spelled out what they required in order for them to be implemented. Robert Tucker, reflecting the plans that had been prepared in the National Security Council, published an article in Commentary in January 1975, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention. Without direct intervention and control, there is a distinct possibility of an economic and political disaster in the United States bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that of the 1930s. And in addressing the question of whether military intervention was feasible, he said, "We cannot intervene everywhere at once, so our intervention depends on identifying a relatively concentrated area of production where we can secure a sufficient portion of world oil production and proven reserves to break OPEC and to effect direct control." And it was in this piece that this area was called the Arab shoreline of the Gulf and the littoral, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. Harper's would then publish a piece called Seizing Arab Oil by Miles Ignotis, who was identified as a Pentagon consultant with intimate links to high-level U.S. policymakers. Miles Ignotis was Edward Luttwak, a long-standing Defense Intelligence Agency functionary. And what was set forth in 1975 was a blueprint for what would become Operation Desert Shield. We have developed rapid deployment and strike operational forces. The 82nd Airborne Division will lead the way with cavalry battalions, which will embark on giant C-5 and C-141 jet transports, refuel at Israeli bases, drop paratroopers at key locations in Saudi oil fields and in Iraq. Escort will be provided by squadrons of phantom fighters based on Israeli fields and carriers in the Arabian Gulf. A plan, codenamed Dahran Option 4, was prepared in the United States National Security Council, which called for direct U.S. attack on the oil fields of Iraq and the seizure of those oil fields. In August 1975, oil fields as a military objective, a feasibility study prepared jointly by Colonel John Collins, senior specialist in national defense, 18 years with contingency planning for the Pentagon, a detailed and elaborated military and operational plan. Indeed, by August 25, 1977, President Carter had issued a secret presidential directive, PD-18, which called for the increase in strike force of the operational military divisions required for, quote, rapid intervention in the Middle East and in the oil-producing areas of the Gulf, of Saudi Arabia, and of Iraq. By June 4, 1978, Admiral Thomas Moore, chairperson of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for the deployment of carriers to prepare for military operations. In 1979, Lawrence Mosher formulated the plan circulating in, quote, Pentagon and National Security Council corridors, what military people call the U.S. 200,000-man quick strike force consisting of divisions rapidly deployable will be put into play. But, he stated, the defense officials have stated, quote, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we will be able to sell the quick strike force, and it may turn out that the boogeyman will not be defined the same in Arabic as in English. Nothing oblique about that. In 1977 and 1978, the revolutionary overthrow of the Shah of Iran was underway. I spent 7 months in Tehran and across Iran during that struggle. It was a struggle that the United States made every effort to crush. The head of NATO was brought to Tehran. He occupied the entire top two floors of the Hilton in Tehran as he tried to prepare for the crushing of these uprisings across Iran. But the problem they had was that the soldiers they wanted to deploy were coming over to the populace, and they were left with an officer class with no standing, no support, and with soldiers turning their weapons on their own officers. So, with the overthrow of the Shah, Zbigniew Brzezinski called a meeting in Kuwait between Saddam Hussein, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, and the Emir al-Sabah of Kuwait, in which the plan was prepared for Iraq to invade Iran and to amputate the oil-producing province Khuzestan, much as Kuwait had been amputated from Mesopotamia by the British in the late 19th century, much as Katanga and Kasai had been amputated from the Congo in the UN-supervised rape of the Congo and the murder of Patrice Lumumba and the destruction of Congolese independence. They calculated that the seizure of Khuzestan, where oil production occurred, would destroy the Iranian revolution, and they based themselves also on the assumption that because the Arab minority in Iran was concentrated in Khuzestan, and the majority Farsi people under the Shah and under Khomeini had persecuted the Arab minority, as indeed the Kurds were in the north and the Baluchi in the east, what they didn't understand and what they didn't take into account is that the oil workers in Khuzestan were the most politicized sector of the Iranian working class, members of the National Party of Mossadegh, members of the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party of Iran, long struggling for the capture of their own oil, and they resisted that invasion. So now, the United States came up with its alternate plan. Henry Kissinger has called it Bleed 'em Both White. And they armed Saddam Hussein with biological and chemical weapons, every single one of which was produced in this country and supplied under U.S. direction, while the Israelis armed the Iranians. And in that regard, how many times have we heard the Pentagon and Bush and Victoria Clark, the Pentagon spokesperson who they interview repeatedly on the main media with these reporters who are in bed with the military forces and with the intelligence agencies of the United States as they orchestrate this war of destruction? And Victoria Clark has talked about the crime of Halabja, the poisoning by gas of the Kurdish population. In 1990, Stephen Pelletier, with the War College, published a report in which it was documented that the cyanide gas used in Halabja had been, in fact, used by the Iranians and supplied by the Israelis. That the gases that were deployed in the hands of the armed forces of Iraq were primarily mustard gases and did not include the cyanide agents that were in play at Halabja. Now that Pelletier document is a Defense Intelligence Agency and Marine Command document, and it is replete with documentation. And Pelletier himself has been prominent in disavowing the fiction. But then who are the point people that Bush and his cronies have assigned to replace Saddam Hussein under direction of Tommy Franks, the military commander of what is to be an occupied Iraq? The Glasgow Sunday Herald on the 22nd of September 2002 unveiled the thugs Bush wants to place in place of Saddam. It's instructive. General Nizar al-Khazraji, the point man. General Nizar al-Khazraji was the field commander in charge of chemical weapons and biological weapons supplied by the United States, which poisoned and burned Iranian civilians and soldiers and opponents of the regime in Iraq. Ambassador David Mack, a senior official in the United States State Department who coordinates the Iraqi opposition, stated that General Nizar al-Khazraji has the right ingredients as the future leader in Iraq. The other point man for the Bush people, for the Iraqi component of American military rule in Iraq, is Brigadier General Najib al-Salihi. He acquired the sobriquet of the Rising Star, but he's also known as the butcher of the Shia population. He was the commander of the armored divisions of the Republican Guard. He was engaged in putting down the uprising of the Shia population, causing 1.5 million people to flee. And he wrote a book about his crushing of the popular uprising entitled Al-Zilzal, The Earthquake. He came over to the United States, for whom he undoubtedly had direct relations through the Central Intelligence Agency, for a sustained period of time dating back to the installation of the regime itself. He came over in 1995. He is considered to be a war criminal and was so indicted in Copenhagen. And then there's Ahmad Shalabi, longtime face of the Iraqi opposition, Central Intelligence Agency operative, who embezzled the funds from the principal bank in Amman, Jordan, and is under a 30-year sentence in absentia. It's the same bunch of thugs that they put into office and power under their direction when they overthrew Abdul Karim Qasim. This has absolutely nothing to do with liberating the people of Iraq. This has everything to do with perpetuating their subjugation under the heel of American imperialism for the benefit of the oil corporations who would seize their oil.
You've been listening to Ralph Schoenman's presentation of Treason at the Top. And Treason at the Top is our premium for taking aim for the WBAI Fund Drive. 212-209-2950. Your gift, your donation to WBAI, it's our gift to you for your donation of $100 to keep and sustain WBAI. And Ralph has been speaking about the subjugation and the takeover of Iraq. And the Center for Public Integrity, which does investigative journalism and has a website, www.publicintegrity.org, has an incredible analysis called Windfalls of War, the U.S. Contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which it shows the dollars that the friends of the U.S. ruling class, the friends of those that they maintain in power, they are windfalls of war. And the top U.S. contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan won't surprise you, and particularly won't surprise those of you who have been listening to us over the past several years. KBR Halliburton, yes, Halliburton, of Vice President Dick Cheney's former company. Bechtel, which recently got a couple of billion-dollar contract to build an airport in Qatar. International American Products. Perlini, which is another major corporation which builds roads and has a lot of engineering projects, particularly in New Jersey. Floor Daniels and Louis Berger, another group that may be familiar to people in the tri-state region of New York. Major, major corporations that got their start during World War II. And actually, even before, in the era of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that's when KBR, which joined later with Halliburton, started with building roads in Texas, and it was Lyndon Baines Johnson, who got them the contract for building dams in Texas and also federal subsidies from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And we went into that in great detail in our Crony Capitalism series, our three-part series, just one of the many programs that we bring to you on Taking AIM. Ralph?
Well, Maya, you know, it's interesting that when in Treason at the Top, where we were, I was talking about Nizar al-Salehi, who had been the head of the Republican Guard and had been long working with the CIA. He came over to the United States in 1995, once again during the Clinton watch. In fact, as I mentioned, Salehi, who carried out the mass devastation of the Shia population and the destruction of the marshes in the Arabs in the Iraqi south. 1995 has another particular importance. In the first month of bombing alone over Yugoslavia, 3,000 cruise missiles were launched and over 7,000 tons of explosives directed to the industrial infrastructure. Every city of any size was devastated. Particularly targeted were factories, communications, transportation roads, and all working-class housing districts. In the Leskovac region alone, 3,500 industrial plants were destroyed. 51 factories manufacturing pharmaceuticals, machinery, agriculture equipment, aircraft, electronics, rails, construction materials, general merchandise, food storage facilities, automobiles, metals, base fittings, plastics, printing equipment, furniture, textiles, devastated. In the city of Nice, the Los Angeles Times reported on the Clinton's watch, the fuel stores and oil depots were struck, causing an enormous firestorm. Quote, the fire from the fuel dumps was so intense, half the city was in flames. The destruction embraced 21 hospitals and clinics, 200 schools, and 10,000 public housing. Consequences, it's only the beginning of the devastation of Yugoslavia that was under Clinton's watch and prepared, of course, for General Clark at the helm for what occurred in Iraq.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because it was when General Wesley Clark, who promoted, above all, the use of extensive firepower and the involvement of NATO in with the extensive firepower.
Not only that, Maya, but Wesley Clark gloats about the depleted uranium that was deployed throughout Yugoslavia.
Before you continue, Ralph, let's remind everyone you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and reaching out to the tri-state region and on the internet at www.wbai.org. If you're just tuning in, this is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and our program is Taking AIM. Today we're presenting Treason at the Top. It's our gift to you, our premium for Taking AIM and the sustaining WBAI, $100 contribution, and you can call 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Treason at the Top is a program is especially edited, very high-fidelity CD, thanks to Yara Mako of KPFA's Guns and Butter, who had recorded and also edited Treason at the Top for us. Not missing a single word, but just tightening up, doing all that fine audio editing for which Yara was so wonderful. Treason at the Top, $100, 212-209-2950. Your contribution sustains Taking AIM on the air. We would not be on the air were it not for WBAI. And in speaking about Iraq, we had been preparing shows since August of 2002. And I go back and look on our program archive at www.takingaim.info. You can see going back to August 13th, programs Peace Soup of Deception, speaking about the bombing, the hundreds of thousands of air raids dropping on the in southern and in northern Iraq. Prior to the war, right. This has been going on ever since the end of the first Gulf War, and then also with the Trojan Horse, the United Nations role in Iraq, and the plans to break up Iraq, seize oil, and how Iraq fit into the plans for permanent war that have been that Ralph has been describing, the plans that go back to the 1970s and the development of the category of terror.
Well, Maya, let me mention one thing, not just with respect to our programming, but in something we call Death and Devastation in the Balkans, an anatomy of global capitalist design, taking once again the benchmark year of 1995, the Clinton period, the very period when the devastation in Iraq was being prepared on the ground prior to the war, the Bush war. Let's look at the following. This is the New York Times on April 11th, 1995. Money managers are of the opinion that the military stock represents the greatest pocket of value. Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop, Grumman, Litton Industries, and General Dynamics. This is the place to put your money. The important numbers are the Clinton administration's plans for the Defense Department increases for the coming fiscal year to escalate right through 2005, writes the New York Times on April 11, 1995. This administration wants a steady increase in outlay for weapons procurement. Key areas have been earmarked for a great increment in allocated funds. The key managers' investment portfolios are voting with their multi-billion dollar checkbooks, writes the New York Times, both with respect to support for the Clinton administration and for its investments in Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, etc. Now, considering that Colonel M. Thomas Davis of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment revealed in the Wall Street Journal on May 4th, 1995, quote, "The war in the Balkans is a rehearsal. It is a rehearsal for the Middle East." And that theme was picked up again, 1995, by the New Republic in an important piece called The Third American Empire. Quote, "The Balkans are the western frontier of America's rapidly expanding sphere of control in the Middle East. We are establishing suzerainty with a forward program. The disintegration of Yugoslavia is our strategic undertaking, long in preparation and essential to U.S. global plans. Even before the first war against Iraq, the main purpose of NATO countries is to serve as staging areas for American wars in the Balkans, the Mediterranean, and after that, the Persian Gulf," unquote. Now this, again, under the Democratic administration of Clinton, all of the elements of the Bush plans for which 9/11 was the pretext, already announced and in preparation in the main media, the main organs of the ruling class. This was the real source of genocide in the Balkans, the conversion of every country, region, and populace into a source of primary resources and atomized cheap labor. Industry destroyed, economies laid low, production disappearing, societies disintegrating, indigenous sovereign authority collapsing, precarious work, random, unprotected, brutal, and policed by mercenary bands defining the waking lives of the vast majority of the working population. That is capitalism at work. That's what treason at the top is about. That's what these wars of predation service. That's why we need, the ruling class needs, the pretext of the category of terrorism, or with the hand of intelligence all over these pseudo-terrorists that are under state management and direction. Support this programming. Call in your support, brothers and sisters. We're not going to let up. We're going to continue with the documentation, with the exposés, and with the analysis. But we need your support. We appeal for it. Please call and support Taking Aim, WBAI, and Pacifica.
212-209-2950. Treason at the Top, for your generous donation to WBAI of $100. And those of you who can afford more, please, this is the moment to come forward. 212-209-2950. We're going to be with you until 11:30, at which time there'll be the WBAI election candidates forum, and we hope that before 11:30, those of you who are waiting till the very last moment, you're going to be calling 212-209-2950. We're at a disadvantage here in California because we can't hear the phones ringing or see those lights lighting up. We know you're making the effort, and we want you to make that extra special effort to call right now. Important to do it before we're off the air, because this is your only opportunity to get Treason at the Top. 212-209-2950. An analysis that will arm you and help you in your everyday life and in your organizing efforts. Remember, March 20th is coming up, and this is a moment to prepare to be able to speak to everyone you meet. 212-209-2950. We're going to return again to another part of Ralph's presentation, and this will be the last part that we're going to play of his presentation of Treason at the Top. To hear the complete analysis and to hear it all the way through, this is the moment to call 212-209-2950. Did you? Do you want to continue?
On September 22, 2002, the cover of the magazine section of the New York Times had a story called The Sunshine Warrior by Bill Keller, referring to the young Pentagon analyst of the 70s, the point man for the plans for the occupation of Iraq, one Paul Wolfowitz, who was introduced by General Eric K. Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, who pointed out with what the New York Times described as a virtual drum roll that Wolfowitz had been involved in preparing for the occupation of Iraq and for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country in turn since the 1970s, at least a dozen years before Desert Storm, that he was a cohort of Richard Perle of the Defense Policy Board, that he was linked to Douglas Feith, who worked for Perle in the Reagan Defense Department, that he was part of something called the Project for a New American Century and the Committee on the Present Danger, that indeed these plans were directly connected to something called the Oded Yinon Plan of the late 1970s. The Oded Yinon Plan was a Mossad and Israeli plan which called for the breakup of each Middle Eastern country in its turn, with Iraq as the first target to be fragmented, its resources seized, and then Saudi Arabia to follow with Egypt at its prize, ad seriatim. It became the benchmark essay from which the plans of what are called the neocons, the people associated with the Project for the New American Century, are so intimately bound. The Israeli journalist Neve Gordon published an instructive article about the genesis of all this, and indeed it bears upon the very notion of the category of terror. Because in the National Security Council, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, they calculated, they looked for a new rationale for massive armament, for perpetuating the war budget, and for creating the pretexts for new wars of dominion on the part of the United States. And that was the category of terror. When Benjamin Netanyahu, according to the articles in Nair in Israel, and the piece by Neve Gordon, was a key instrument in this operation. A Central Intelligence Agency operative, Mr. Netanyahu, operated under four names, and they disclosed four Social Security numbers. He was, after all, an American citizen as well. The name under which he operated in the United States was John J. Sullivan. And Mr. Netanyahu was engaged in particular in preparing conferences on the presence of terror. The 27-year-old Netanyahu organized a conference in Tel Aviv at which Bush and George Shultz and leaders of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Council were present. By 1984, the Council on Foreign Relations established another such conference in New York with George Shultz and Bush Sr. present and coordinating, By 1985, Schultz chaired another Netanyahu-organized conference on terrorism. And by the way, the Social Security number that was disclosed, 02036-4537, in the name of John J. Sullivan, was indeed the operational name, the code name for Netanyahu in this work of preparing for the category of terror. Much of this has by now been thoroughly documented. The seminal piece by Jason Vest in The Nation on September 2nd of last year, The Men from Jinsa and the Committee on the Present Danger, a group of right-wing defense intellectuals, a cornerstone of a shadow establishment throughout the Carter years, centered in the National Security Agency, but in particular in the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, Jinsa, and the Center for Security Policy, linked to the Likud. Richard Perle was the campaign manager for Netanyahu. Perle, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, the man who is supposed to oversee the entire reconstruction process in Iraq, Jay Garner, part of Jinsa, part of the Committee on the Present Danger. A grand strategy for the Middle East, the article in The Nation describes, was prepared by the Defense Policy Board. Iraq is the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia is the strategic lever, and Egypt is the prize. Since 1976, these plans have moved from operational plans in the councils of state to policy, orchestrated through something called the American Enterprise Institute. American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, a series of conferences, the New Atlantic Initiative, which laid out the new policies for NATO, the American Enterprise Institute, Friday, November 30th, 2001. Richard Perle, Wolfowitz, Jean Kirkpatrick. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, we shall prepare for the seizure of countries in this region and for changing the regimes perforce. We all know the list of states. Frequently I am asked the question, can we go to war with these 10 countries at once? My answer is, we will take them in their turn. But the list, he said, is longer than that. Phase two will be Iraq. But after Iraq comes Iran and Syria and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia and Yemen and Libya and beyond. As explicit as a Mein Kampf. These plans are elaborated in the highest councils of state, in the American Enterprise Institute, now on the 20th of June, 2002, tackling terror, NATO's new mission, a speech by the NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson at the American Enterprise Institute's New Atlantic Initiative. The primary purpose of NATO will now be to dislodge any states we deem to be harboring terrorists. The role of the Project for a New American Century has been spelled out now by ABC News, a memo in 1998, a blueprint for the Iraq War. The group, the Project for the New American Century, founded in 1997, peopled by Wolfowitz and Perle and Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, calling for the dismantling of Iraq as a preparatory step for the seizure of control in countries across the Middle East and beyond. A blueprint, it's called. In the British press, America Pearl Harbored, says the Independent in London, because Condoleezza Rice and the ideologues in the Project for a New American Century declared that in order to be able to impose this ad seriatim preemptive and permanent war on the American people, it would be necessary to have a catastrophe on the scale of Pearl Harbor. John Pilger has written extensively in the New Statesman, the Daily Mirror in London, have carried the details about these plans. The neocons, however, are not confined to the Republican Party. The project for the new American century now encompasses the principal national security personnel of the Clinton administration. Robert Asmus, the Deputy Secretary of State for Europe under Clinton, Ivo Dalder, in charge of Clinton's National Security Council staff, Robert Gelbard, the U.S. Ambassador to Chile and Indonesia, Martin Indyk, Clinton's Ambassador to Israel, Dennis Ross, his Chief Advisor on Palestinian Affairs, Walter Slocum, Clinton's top policy official at the Pentagon, and James Steinberg, Clinton's National Security Advisor, who now heads foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, all integrated now with the so-called neocons, all part of the process, all prepared. These people, as I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks, hardly operate in a vacuum. What they represent is a ruling class that has moved to the point where the crisis of humanity and the world's crisis is indeed the crisis of imperialism. For so fragile is this economic order, so incapable of meeting the most elementary needs of human beings across the planet, so dependent upon an all-out assault upon the gains that working people have made in this country for the past 100 years, so addicted to war and armament and permanent aggression as their solution to the crisis as a system, that they are prepared to impose upon this people in the United States, through the instrument of state terror of their own authorship, the means of perpetuating their fragile rule. The United States publication Insight on the News reported on August 10, 2001, every year trillions of dollars are unaccounted for by federal agencies. Robert Lieberman, the Deputy Inspector General of the Department of Defense, admitted that $4.4 trillion in the Pentagon's books were cooked to compile required financial statements. In 1 year, $1.1 trillion were gone. No accounting for them. Untold trillions of dollars, the report continues, are stolen every year, disappear into offshore numbered accounts, holding companies, and banks without record. In the year 2000, the Pentagon, quote, lost $855 billion, which is more than the total taxes collected in 1999. On September 10, 2001, the day before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, CBS News and its anchor Dan Rather reported that the Pentagon had lost $2.3 trillion, full one quarter of its budget for the decade. How do you lose $2.3 trillion? Let's put this in a little bit of perspective here. Helen Caldicott, the anti-nuclear activist in Australia, did a calculation. $1 trillion represents $1,000 every minute since the life of Jesus. This kleptocracy, this bunch of gangsters who call themselves the government of the United States, the rulers of our society, are cannibalizing the infrastructure of this society. They are engaged in a process that requires the pauperization of the many, not only abroad in this race to the bottom, where workers are whipsawed and pitted against each other, where they shut down an auto plant in Ypsilanti and open it up in Shenzhen, China, where they can pay people $34 a month, where they close down the plant in Michigan or in upstate New York and they open it up in Toluca and pay people $6 a day, where Raytheon shuts down in San Diego and opens up in across the border in the maquiladoras to pay people 69 cents an hour. And then they say to American workers, you have to be competitive, you have to get lean and mean, you have to give up the 8-hour day, you have to forget about health care, you forget about your social benefits, you forget about your union protections, you forget about the gains of 100 years that have been struggled for by generation after generation in the society to support a rapacious, degenerate system, the addicted to war. How many of you are familiar with something called Operation Northwoods? In 1962, and these are now documents that were secured after the Assassination Information Act, which allowed the release of documents pertaining to the execution of John F. Kennedy after the Oliver Stone movie, JFK. The former producer of ABC News Tonight with Peter Jennings, James Bamford, obtained documents which were under the heading of Operation Northwoods. It was prepared in the National Security Council in 1962, was the particular project of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Lyman Limnitzer. It was signed off on and approved by every single member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was an operational plan in the National Security Council. It called for the hijacking of airplanes and the crashing of these planes into buildings in the United States. It called for the assassination of U.S. civilian citizens in Miami, in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C. It called for and programmed the explosion of the rocket-carrying John Glenn astronaut and attributing every bit of this to the Cuban Revolution. Not the wet dream of marginal people. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, every single member of the Joint Chiefs signing off on this operational plan.
You've been listening to Treason at the Top, and we've left you hanging for a purpose. The purpose is for you to call 212-209-2950 so that you can have your copy of Treason at the Top. Because what follows is Ralph's dynamic discussion of the events of 9/11. And we're not going to play that tonight. For that, you have to send in your donation to WBAI for Treason at the Top, 212-209-2950. Because in this lecture, Treason at the Top, Ralph synthesizes much of what we've been saying on many of our shows, our extended shows. The first months were 2 hours, and then for our one-hour drive time show over the past year and a half, Treason at the Top puts it all together in a way that allows you to absorb it, to remember it, to repeat it, to make it your own. And that is the purpose of these special programs like Treason at the Top. 212-209-2950. Those of you who are listening now who normally hear jazz music and lay back and go about your business, if you ever tune in at 5 o'clock and listen to the dynamic interplay between Ralph and me, Maya Schoen, many people say it's like listening to jazz music, but jazz music with information and analysis that arm you to affect change in your life. 212-209-2950. And when Ralph was making his presentation on Treason at the Top, it brought home what I've been doing actually over the last few days in preparing a newsletter called Long-Term Care News and Views for an advocacy agency here in the San Francisco Bay Area that works primarily with frail elderly seniors who live on income between $700 a month, less than $1,000 a month in a very expensive community and must depend on caregivers, home caregivers, that are subsidized by the county, the state, and the federal government in what is called the In-Home Supportive Services Program. And this is a program that was won over 30 years ago, around the same time that Medicare was implemented here in the United States. And this is a program that's under devastating attack. Assault from an every avenue, assault on health care, assault on the basic services that enable people to remain outside of nursing homes, outside of institutional care. As you're all aware, in California, we have a 100-millionaire, probably 200-300-millionaire governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And known as the Gropenführer.
The Gropenführer, the Terminator. And the Terminator, so proud of his movie, is terminating basic services. Instead of raising the tax rate for billionaires, just millionaires here in California, that would bring in $2 billion a year. What he proposes with his with the budget that he has presented to the California legislature is to cut essential health and welfare programs for these poor elderly people, for the people with disabilities, for children, low-income children and immigrants, $2.7 billion to cap enrollment, to slash health and welfare programs, taking from the most needy, taking from the people who supply the individual taxes in this state in order to keep the wealthy buying more and more stocks, buying more and more Hummers, as
well,
he so proudly has, assaulting the basic services. And it's here on WBAI that these issues are addressed. And it is here during Taking AIM that we try to put it all together for you. So please call now, 212-209-2950. Without this station, without this analysis, without moving our class forward, you won't have an opportunity to lay back and listen to the wonderful jazz music that is brought to you normally at this time on WBAI.
Well, Maya, I want to point out that the Grobenfuhrer's policies, it has to be said, as grotesquely oppressive and exploitative as they are that the continuation of those of his predecessor, the Democratic Governor Gray Davis. And Maya, who had been the communications director for the healthcare workers, Local 250, of SEIU, she was representing 40,000 workers. The SEIU 250 documented the following. It's dramatic, and I think it's, our listeners should hear it. The health of the workers of the world, and particularly in the United States, are in crisis mode. But listen to what the distribution of income was for those who were in charge of health corporations. Richard L. Scott of Columbia SCA received $265.5 million in 1 year. Peter Nicholson of Boston Scientific Corporation received $231.1 million. David Jones of Humana, Inc., a salary of $194.4 million. Leon C. Hirsch of U.S. Surgical Corporation paid $105.8 million. That's just the salary. Maya and Local 250 documented the following. Leonard Abramson of U.S. Healthcare received stock options of $11.4 million, outright stock holdings of $783.9 million, a total compensation package of $805,122,045 in 1 year. The total federal spending on AIDS under Clinton was half the value of the stock holdings of the top health industry executives. And this sort of thing is across the board amongst corporate conglomerates, and it was documented again in the special report in Business Week on April 20th, 1998. These are the Clinton years, brothers and sisters. The Gropenfuhrer and the Bushmen, and behind every Bush is a terrorist. These people are but continuing and intensifying the same policies of our ruling class. It's capitalism was at issue here, brothers and sisters. That's what Taking AIM is seeking to explicate, to document, and to establish for our listeners. Please support this programming and this information. Call in your support. Call in for treason at the top.
And it's become obvious to anyone who has eyes and who can see what is happening. As Bob Herbert, who writes notable columns in the New York Times, wrote on January 9th, 2004, in his opinion piece called The Cruel Reality.
I would say my rather has a heart.
Has a heart.
Because people who are without eyes are quite capable of registering information.
True. And true. Again, especially since I'm quoting people who are blind in my newsletter. The cruel reality, writes Herbert, the cruel reality is that Americans at the top are thriving at the expense of the well-being of those at the bottom and increasingly in the middle. And this has been the case of capitalism all along, as Ross had stated, and Bob Herbert should recognize. It was during the Democratic administrations that this also has taken place. For the past over 20 years and more, the real wages of workers in the United States have been declining. They have not been going up. That's the real wages of the workers of this country. But as Bob Herbert writes, it seems strange to him that we're going backward in the 21st century in our ability to provide the most fundamental kinds of health care to ordinary people, including children. And it seems strange, but what we have been doing on Taking AIM, what we have analyzed, is to show you that it is not strange. It is the systematic inevitability of the private ownership of the means of production of capitalism. And it is through the analysis and treason at the top, through the analysis and the underlying politics of 9/11, through the analysis of our specials like Why War or World War IV, that we bring you extensively and in one package the opportunity to have a textbook, to have the insight, to have, as I said before, to make this analysis your own. 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. You're not going to find Treason at the Top at your local bookstore. You're not going to find Treason at the Top played on CNN, ABC, or any of the, or NPR. It's only on WBAI that you can hear such programs. It's up to you to keep WBAI on the air. It's up to you to keep Taking AIM on the air. It's up to you. It's up to all of us. We each do our part. 212-209-2950. Any donation, $25, gets you a low-income membership in WBAI. And remember that WBAI takes all forms of payment, cash, checks, and debit cards and credit cards. I hate to mention those things, but it is true. That is the way that we can put our payments over time. Treason at the Top, 212-209-2950. In a moment, after Ralph says another word, we're going to go to another part of the presentation, which is one that I made. We're just going to play short segments of it because I want to have an opportunity tonight to also play some of the many questions and answers, the dynamism that happens between the people in the audience and Ralph with questions and response. But before we do, keep those phones ringing, 212-209-2950. And in the section of Treason at the Top, I particularly look at the assault on the gains of workers and also the setting up of the terror apparatus here in the United States with the Patriot Act, with the military operations other than war, a section of which we played last week during our regular Taking AIM time schedule about how the military was used in Seattle and in Philadelphia.
Well, you know, Treason at the Top attempts to provide not only a structural underpinning for the wars abroad and the repression at home, but a historical context as well. Woodrow Wilson spoke, quote, of making the world safe for democracy, using the kind of rhetoric that every administration used to justify its wars of predation. But when Woodrow Wilson was addressing manufacturers of the United States, he was very clear, quote, if we don't impose our enterprise abroad, we cannot afford liberty at all in this country. It will be a luxury we cannot tolerate. Our industry is at the point where it collapses unless we establish control of the world market, because our home market is no longer sufficient. We must have some foreign domination. Woodrow Wilson, the Patriot Act antecedents are very clear in the workings of capitalism. Administration or of one political coloring or another, if it's a capitalist control of the state, these are the policies that are going to be inflicted upon us, rhetoric aside.
Okay, and remember that the portion you didn't hear is an analysis of 9/11 in Ralph's presentation. So 212-209-2950, and we're going now to the beginning of my presentation in Treason at the Top.
Good evening. Just as the Pentagon and President Bush are discovering that the people of Iraq resist and are resisting the mightiest armed force in the world today, So too, here in the United States and throughout the world, millions upon millions of people have been resisting these genocidal designs against the people of the Middle East. But also, here in the United States, there has been a long-standing war against us, against the workers, against the people who do not own the means of production, but yet who create all the value that exists in this country and throughout the world. 1 hour before President Bush went on television the evening of March 17th to issue his ultimatum to the people of Iraq, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge went on national television to state that there was a terrorism threat and he was going to make an orange alert. As soon as the bombs started dropping, they raised this alert to red. They announced a security plan called Operation Liberty Shield, which calls for unprecedented domestic security measures. Supposedly, these measures were to protect us from so-called terrorist threats. In fact, these measures are to block our descent. If we look throughout history at the times when National Guards have been called out throughout the United States, whether it was Coeur d'Alene in Idaho or at Kent State, we notice that these are moments when the people of the United States, be they trade unionists fighting for their rights in Idaho or in San Francisco with a general strike in the 1930s, or in Minneapolis in another general strike in the 1930s, you have the National Guard sent out to suppress the workers from their attempts to have control over their lives. Or at Kent State, where students were objecting to the Vietnam War, you have the National Guard called out. In the United States, after March 17th, just a few days later, Congress considered the U.S. budget. $2.2 trillion is what they allocated and what they voted. Now, I don't think that it's incidental that in approving this $2.2 trillion budget, at the same moment that they eliminated $110 billion from the Medicaid program, which provides health insurance for the most impoverished people in the United States, 36 million people, and 3.9 of whom are frail elderly or people with disabilities who rely upon Medicaid in order to live independently in their homes, or if they must, in nursing homes. At the same time that they eliminated $110 billion to the most impoverished for their health care, they made room in this $2.2 trillion for over $100 billion for the first stage of the war against Iraq. Because they knew that when the Pentagon and President Bush were going to Congress with an estimate of $100 billion for the first stage, they knew that they were going to be asked to give them a blank check. As President Bush and Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld said, "We cannot tell you how long this war is going to last, and we also cannot tell you what it's going to cost." And you didn't see this Congress rise up and say, No. Instead, they allocated over $100 billion for what they knew and what they had been told over and again was only the first increment, the first increment. And at the same time, they cut the comparable amount, $110 billion, from the most impoverished, the most frail, the most at risk, poor children, the frail elderly, and people with disabilities. This is not a coincidence. This has happened time and time again. When the railroad workers were going to go out on strike at the time of the Clinton administration, Congress stayed up late into the night and passed emergency measures to make sure those workers did not go out on strike. And when the Caterpillar workers were on strike, and Caterpillar had less than 1 month of inventory, Caterpillar was going to have to succumb to the demands of the United Auto Workers, who were organized throughout the country and who had a viable strike fund in order to stay out on strike. The demand of the union movement in this country was very simple. A strike can be successful as long as there are no replacement workers. As long as you don't bring workers from another part of the country to take their place. Because there are people who need money and will take the place of the union workers. Not because they're bad people, but they too have families to feed. And that is what is called pitting one worker against another. And what the union movement asked of President Clinton and the Democratic Congress was to pass a bill, to pass legislation. It was the number one priority of the AFL-CIO, legislation that would ban replacement workers. Throughout the history of the union movement here in the United States, when it was fully developed, the corporations dare not use replacement workers. But as the union movement has been undermined since Reagan with PATCO, if you remember the air controllers strike in the early 1980s, replacement workers have become commonplace. So the number one priority was to have legislation from a Democratic president and a democratically controlled Congress. The very Congress that this AFL-CIO had been so influential in getting elected. Because as you all know, the phone banks and getting people out on the street is done primarily with the union labor. And what happened? President Clinton did not lift the telephone to call any of the swing votes, and the replacement bill was defeated, and the Caterpillar strike was defeated. So it is not just this current Bush administration, but it goes back administration after administration, this war on working people. It is also during the Clinton administration, and I'm discussing this now because it is so important to understand what is happening today. It is also with this Clinton administration that Al Gore had the notion of reinventing government. It was the centerpiece of the Clinton administration. And what does reinventing government mean? It means the privatization of government jobs. It means that the government, as we see today with the Pentagon and the trillions of dollars of which Ralph spoke, it's the privatization. Instead of having government workers at the federal, at the county, at the state, and at the city, the local level, handle the functions of government, of social services, of cleaning the streets, of handling the garbage, of even running our schools. Reinventing government meant the privatization, that the tax dollars from our hard-earned work, that the government was just a pass-through, and that the money would pass through to corporations. Now, this leads back to Homeland Security and the creation of this department with Tom Ridge, former Pennsylvania governor, at its head. The Department of Homeland Security brought almost 25 or 26 departments, federal departments, into one umbrella. It happened during the Bush administration, but it had been crafted by the Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman, who had been Al Gore's vice presidential running mate, and, as Phil Graham noted, 95% of this Homeland Security Department, which controls major intelligence and police agencies at the federal level, 95% of this cabinet-level department was written by Democrats. And one of the first things that President Bush did once this Homeland Security Department, this overarching policing agency throughout the United States dealing with domestic issues, one of the first things he announced was that the 170,000 people, federal workers, union workers, with pensions, with health care benefits, they would no longer be union workers. They would no longer have the strength of the collective expression, the defense organization that a union brings to their jobs. Excuse me, it's 22 agencies. So what does this mean for these 170,000 workers? Union workers in the United States are more likely than non-union counterparts to have health care and pensions. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 73% of union workers in private industry, not public, because in public they do have these benefits because of this vast union activity over the years, but in private industry, 73% of union workers have medical care benefits compared with only 51% of non-union workers. And union workers are likely to have pensions and short-term disabilities. So what you have, when you do have the level of union workers with pensions, with disability benefits, is it creates a standard, and it creates a standard throughout the United States that even non-union employers must meet. So a primary target of the capitalist rulers in the United States has been to undermine, through legislation and through breaking strikes, the very concept of unionization, the very collective expression. Because, as you saw with the International Longshoremen's Union, they can shut down the very operation of this country. And so when the ILWU was in contract negotiations, the first thing that the government said was that they were going to threaten the very union itself and nationalize the ports. They threatened the workers with destroying their very union itself. So this is a method. This is integral. This is integral to the attack, not only on the people of Iraq, where there is a nationalized ownership of oil, where they have national institutions, nationalized public housing, public health, an intention, just like here in the United States, where you can reap more profits through destroying the collective expressions, in the intent in Iraq to privatize oil, to privatize the public housing, to privatize education. And this is clearly spelled out in the plans of the USAID, in the plans that were elaborated by the James Baker Institute at Rice University and the Council on Foreign Relations, in their blueprint for what would be the occupation of Iraq. USAID, Council on Foreign Relations, it is breakup here in the United States, public, whether it's public water, public education, the collective expression in unions, and to do this in country after country that they intend to dominate. There is resistance. There is resistance by workers through their unions, and there is resistance with us, as you saw, the millions of people against these genocidal wars, such as the genocidal war in Vietnam and the genocidal war unfolding as we speak. There was a battle in Seattle. That's what they called it.
You've been listening to Treason at the Top, and it's yours for your generous donation to WBAI 212-209-2950. It's a 2-CD. It'll have high quality. The copy, unfortunately, of this CD isn't as high quality as the duplication that you will receive. It's a very high quality from a professional duplicating house. And it's Treason at the Top, 2 CDs, 2.5 hours, with a presentation by Ralph, a presentation by me on the assault against workers, and including later on about the Patriot Act and military operations against war, and an extensive question and answer period. 212-209-2950 for your donation of $100. This is Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Normally, we're on from 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. Drive time, taking aim. And we're entering our third year on WBAI. It's been amazing, the variety, the response we've had from all of you. We want to thank all of you who write to us. Who write to us by email, and those of you who write us letters, and particularly those of you in prisons. We have people who listen to us here in California at Avenel, and we get letters from prisoners throughout the New Jersey system in particular. And I bring up New Jersey because Ralph found an article on January 18th about how Jersey tops the U.S. in prison disparity, that blacks, African Americans, are 13 times as likely as whites to be behind bars. Is it the largest racial disparity in rates of incarceration of any state? And New Jersey has the dubious distinction of claiming it, says a Star Ledger article by Robert Schwarnberg. And the article goes into great detail why. And the reason has to do with racial profiling and mandatory sentences for small-time drug cases. Meanwhile, you have the trillions of dollars the kleptocracy steals through the Pentagon, or that you have drug companies stealing from Medicare and major hospital and insurance companies stealing from Medicare, and nary a single one of these corporate thieves ever spends a day incarcerated. While in New Jersey, you have the thousands and thousands of youths who are buried alive, buried alive. And buried alive, torture in America is this series that we recently did on Taking Aim. We've done two parts so far, and after the end of the fund drive, we're going to do the third. It gives you an example of the breadth and the depth of the programming that we present. So 212-209-2950, Treason at the Top.
Let me point out that when you cite the article by Schwanenberg in the Star Ledger, please keep in mind, brothers and sisters, that one out of three African-American male youth, males actually, is either in prison, on parole, or in the judicial process. This is a war on black America. This is an all-encompassing onslaught against the most vulnerable and exploited sector of our working population, the African-American population of this country, and in particular male and male youth. Keep in mind, I should point out, that we have essentially here the criminalization of poverty combined with an occupation army in the form of militarized police, SWAT units, and the like. Maya mentioned that drug offenses are deployed as the main instrument for incarceration of black male youth. But the drug industry is run by the DEA and by the Central Intelligence Agency. $500 billion of clear profit processed through American banks. There is no single significant bank in the United States that is not laundering and processing drug money. It's no longer distinguishable from the normal workings of finance capital. $500 billion profit a year expresses itself in ownership of General Dynamics and General Motors. It is the workings of the capitalist state, and the enforcement arm, the DEA and CIA, is heavily involved in the managing and profiteering and using of drugs as a strategic weapon against our populations in the inner cities of this country. As Dick Gregory likes to say, every nine-year-old knows where the heroin man is, but the FBI can't find him. It's not black youth struggling to survive, turning to the dissemination of petty drugs as a vehicle for doing so, that is the real instrument of drug of drug availability in the United States. It's the corporatization and banking processing of the profits, and it's the intelligence direction of this drug traffic and channeling of these drugs into our inner cities. That's the way it works. That's capitalism at work. That's what Treason at the Top is about. The real criminals, that gangster state apparatus, the kleptocracy, they are the rulers, while the poor and the exploited are their victims.
And, Ralph, this article notes that despite surveys showing that whites admit to using and selling illegal drugs at rates equal to or greater than blacks, that New Jersey inmates doing time for drug crimes are overwhelmingly minorities. In fact, 72.8%, that's almost 73%, are black as of last December. And one of the reasons is that the mandatory sentencing is that if you're selling drugs within 500 feet of any public building, park, or housing project, or within 1,000 feet of a school or school bus, you face a mandatory year behind bars without parole. But what is noted is that the suburban kids are inside, not seen by the police, and not within 1,000 feet of the school. And if they're well-to-do, they can afford to go into a private drug treatment and make a convincing argument for probation. And this is revealed in this article, once again, the disparity between the incarceration and the attack on the working class here in the United States. And also linked with drugs, if you people have heard Libya and Lockerbie, our program in the analysis of Pan Am 103, the downing of Pan Am 103 is not what was presented, and that, in fact, relates to drug trafficking by the CIA.
It's, in fact, overwhelmingly documented. It's part of our sustained programming, and it's also discussed in my book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. The documentation was provided by an intelligence operation called Interforce, which is a group of retired former CIA, DIA, Mossad, and German intelligence operatives who set up shop on their own to hire their services out to U.S. corporations. Pan Am 103's insurers retained them because they were facing billions of dollars of damage suits from the family members of those killed in the Lockerbie tragedy. What emerged from the Interforce report, corroborated in Barron's, the Financial Weekly, and in the Toronto Star, is that Pan Am 103 was brought down by the Central Intelligence Agency through operations out of Frankfurt, because on that flight were a group of high-level CIA and DEA operatives coming in from the cold from drug distribution in the Middle East. I don't want to go into all of the particulars now other than to illuminate what Maya was indicating, namely that drugs are a growth industry for American capitalism, administered by the intelligence agencies and designed to criminalize the most disadvantaged and the poor in order to deepen exploitation and to justify the war on black America, in which every inner city is virtually facing an occupying army in the name of its so-called police force.
It's now 11 p.m. We have 1/2 hour left in this Taking AIM special. Although we had said we were originally planned to go till midnight because of the importance of the WBAI elections and the democratization, the choice of choosing a board that can move the station forward into the future, we will be ending at 11:30. So you have 1/2 hour remaining at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and reaching out throughout the tri-state region and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Those of you who are listening and on the West Coast and in countries throughout the world, please, if you have the opportunity, call 212-209-2950. We know you two rely on this station. We recently had a wonderful call from Costa Rica. We know people are listening in Thailand. They're listening in Norway. They're listening in Italy.
They're listening in Iran. They're listening in Cuba. With the wonders of the Internet, Taking AIM is heard all over the world. We have an extraordinarily large reach. And as Maya mentioned, our most loyal and constant audience is in the prison systems in New York and in New Jersey, where those who are buried in the dungeons of our torture chambers called prisons in the United States are reaching out to us. Please reach out to them and support this programming, brothers and sisters.
It's your donations. They're not able to make them. It's your donation. Remember, in the prisons today, people have to buy their toothpaste, their toilet paper. They have to buy most of the food they eat. They have to buy the clothes on their backs and every piece of reading material. They don't have the opportunity to sustain WBAI, but you do. And, by the way, on top of that, any money that's ever sent to them, any money they earn, there's a tax that's taken, a very large tax that's taken off the top. So they are at a great disadvantage, aside from their incarceration.
The prisoners that we represent, Maya, we have an organization longstanding called the Council on Human Needs, which is a prisoner advocacy and prisoner rights nonprofit. These prisoners are earning $18 a month, brothers and sisters. Talk about the plantation system and slave labor. That's what the prison system really is. It's the extension and continuation of slavery, which is another way of driving down the wages of workers who are outside the prison walls, because prison-produced goods are being pitted against the work produced by union labor and non-union labor outside prison walls. It's a system. It's a capitalist order. It's about exploitation and subjugation.
And so we all depend on you. For you to hear Taking AIM, for you to hear the jazz that you normally hear at this time, for you to hear the news, for you to have wake-up call, for you to have all the programs upon which you rely each day, 24/7. Now is the moment, and our gift to you is Treason at the Top for your generous contribution of $100. There are other ways to make contributions. Any amount is important, and we particularly like it when you donate during Taking AIM. We pride ourselves on the fact that we've been able to do a good share of fundraising for WBAI. The station means a lot to us, and we know it means to you too. 212-209-2950. And again, our email, if you'd like to reach us, is takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net, or you can remember takingaim@wbai.org. I'm going to give you our number here in California because someone fills up our number at WBAI, and that's 707 707-552-9995. If you leave a message, we'll call you back. That's 707-552-9995. But today the number to remember is 212-209-2950 for your generous contribution to sustain WBAI. Remember all the staff and all the unpaid producers and all the people who volunteer appreciate what you do and what we do, too. We all appreciate our own work, and this is the time. This is the moment. You know, WBAI comes to you several times a year, not each and every 6 and 7 minutes as commercial radio does, bombarding us on commercial radio with advertisement. But here is your chance, Treason at the Top, and we provide a gift for you, 212-209-2950. And, Tijir, if you're listening, I'm going to go to Ralph, and then after that, instead of continuing with my presentation, let's go to the questions and answer period, because that's something we don't usually leave enough time for people to hear, and I think that they'll enjoy the two questions. There are many, many questions in the 53 minutes of question and answers, and I selected two of them for you tonight. And Russ?
Well, I only wanted to mention that we've been talking about the structure of capitalism, the nature of its control. I cited before Woodrow Wilson when he was speaking before the Manufacturers Association and really describing how the rulers have to have foreign control. The same statement was made by his successor, Herbert Hoover. Foreign control is more important for us to ensure the stable functioning of our capitalist economy because it assumes a greater importance than home consumption, unquote. And later I will cite to you the statement by the National Industrial Conference Board Director Virgil Jordan of Franklin Roosevelt. Virgil Jordan, the president of the National Industrial Conference Board, said on December 10, 1940, and I'll just give the first sentence, whatever the outcome of this war, we have taken the road of imperialism on an economic plane as on all other planes of life, unquote. And he goes on to elaborate why U.S. imperial control of global resources is the program of the future for the rulers of the United States.
The continuation of my presentation in Treason at the Top is a detailed analysis of the Patriot Act, of operations other than war, the military operations, in other words, the suppression of activity. But also, it is a call to resistance. For instance, on March 20th, we have a demonstration coming up, and we expect that all of you who are listening are going to participate. And Treason at the Top is a good way to have the analysis, to speak to each and every person you know, to convince them that they, too, should be participating in those demonstrations. 212-209-2950. And we're going to go to the question and answer period.
That's right. We're going to go right to the question and answers, but I did want to make this slight announcement correction for 11:30. Yes, WBAI, we love to think of our elections as the big thing, but actually, there's another election. Oh, that election. At 11:30 p.m., Robert Knight will be giving us election coverage for that other election in the New Hampshire primary. Please stay tuned now, WBAI, continuing with Maya Schoen and Ralph Schoenman, Taking Aim, Questions and Answers. 212-209-2950.
Hi. I was wondering why, or if you could explain why Egypt is the prize.
Well, the World Zionist Organization, in its 1982 document of Kivinon Yinom, of Oded Yinon, considered that Egypt was the largest in population of the Arab states and with the most substantial army. And consequently, Egypt is considered to be a significant country, perhaps the most important of the Arab nations, and particularly targeted. Egypt is the prize because it was, after all, the locus of the 1952 officers' revolution of Naguib and Nasser, and led to the nationalization of the Suez Canal and the radicalization of the Arab people in their struggle against colonial and imperial dominion. Egypt is the second largest recipient after the Israeli colonial settler state of U.S. subsidy. The Israeli state gets about $14 billion a year. It averages about $30,000 per individual in Israel. It's essentially an extension of U.S. imperialism in the region. And what basically has occurred is that the Zionist state has become joined at the hip to policymakers now at the central points of control in the U.S. government itself, and consequently what was the Oded Yinon plan has become the operational plan that we see through the PMAC and through the Center for the Present Danger and the Defense Policy Board that's at work right now. But, you know, you'll find in all of the documents of the PNAC and in the American Enterprise Institute and in the security memoranda of Wolfowitz and Pearl, known as the Prince of Darkness in the established press, the repetition, literally, of the Oded Yinon plan. I mean, the reification of the Oded Yinon plan, in which Egypt is the strategic prize in the Arab East for fragmentation. What the former foreign minister of Israel called the restoration of the millet system of the Ottoman Empire, in which each Arab state will be reconformed to its ethnic and religious components. And that's the language they use.
I'm trying to understand why George Bush, even though I understand he's ruling class, he's famous for being so stupid. Why would they put him up there to lead? Why would he be in public office at all in this scenario?
In 1992, the Houston Chronicle ran an investigative series which described an investigation by something called FinCEN, Financial Central Investigation Unit of the Treasury Department, and by the Federal Bureau of Investigation at the time, into the operations of a group of money launderers and drug smugglers and arms operatives in the Middle East who had previously functioned through the BCCI, you know, the huge bank that was exposed and then collapsed. And they were running money through to a company called Harkin Energy, which was the company of somebody named George W. Bush. The people who were engaged in this operation in basically stealing and laundering hundreds of billions of dollars were Khalid bin Mahfouz, the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's father and brother. The American vehicle for this was a guy named James R. Bath, as the Houston Chronicle articles exposed. And it was orchestrated by a rather mysterious but important figure named Jackson Stevens, whose base was in Mena, Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, and in Venice, Florida. He's a multimillionaire, hundred-millionaire, and in charge of the National Security Agency offices in Venice, Florida, and a principal funder of both the Republican and Democratic parties, a critical figure in the career of Clinton in Arkansas and linked to the Bushes from the inception of father and son. Harkin Energy muted into something called the Carlyle Group, a $14 billion operation which is linked essentially to it's a company linked to the arms industry in the United States and the pharmaceutical industry in the United States, associated with a company called Biotech in Michigan, which was responsible for developing anthrax vaccines and is linked to all the drug companies, major drug companies, Eli Lilly and Searle, that the Carlyle Group regroups, which includes, it's a who's who of the Republican Party administration of the moment, with Rumsfeld and Ashcroft all engaged in the boards of these companies. It's huge, multi-billion dollar profiteering for the pharmaceutical companies and the arms industry. Carlyle Group. Bioport is linked to the production of vaccine. Now, the Gulf War veterans have documented that over Nearly 200,000 Gulf War veterans have been affected by two things, depleted uranium and by forced vaccination of contaminated vaccine. The huge profiteering that has been realized out of this by the component members of the Carlyle Group has been documented not only in the Houston Chronicle, but across the board. Osama bin Laden's father and brother, and Khalid bin Mahfouz, the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, were the business partners of George W. Bush, acknowledged in the Wall Street Journal, in the Baltimore Sun, in the Baltimore Sentinel. The documentation there. What did this man say? Those who have financial dealings with the terrorists, those who give succor to the terrorists, we shall hunt them down. He should look in his bedroom and look in the mirror. Both. Senior flew, as did James Baker, with the father of Osama bin Laden to Paris for what was called the October Surprise. If you're familiar with that, there was the meeting with the representatives of Khomeini in Paris on the eve of the election, in which Ronald Reagan was opposing Jimmy Carter, in which a deal was cut. The hostages would not be released until after the election. It was called the October Surprise. One of the interlocutors for the Bushes in this operation was Osama bin Laden's father and brother. The plane carrying back Osama bin Laden's father never made it. You know, it's like the one, like Flight 93. It crashed. In the case of Flight 93, the fuselage and the wings were scattered over 5 miles in that so-called crash. In the case of Osama bin Laden's father, similar circumstances, was taken out. Osama bin Laden's brother died in such a plane crash as well. They have intimate, documented, long-standing, enormously important financial relationship to Bush father and son through Harkin Energy, through the Carlyle Group, through the instrument of the BCCI. It goes even back to the Nugan Hand Bank in Australia, where Oliver North was a coordinator, from which actually the Maya described as FEMA emerged. This is a gangster ruling class connected to arms deals, laundering of money, drug trafficking to sustain their covert ops. And the instruments or agencies of disclosure are those of the federal government itself, of course, to get cut off at the pass. Who is engaged in the process of terrorizing the American people about the imminent prospect of smallpox and other, so that everybody has to get vaccinated with a tainted vaccine? Where does the profit go for that operation? The Carlyle Group is the central controlling element of the key pharmaceutical companies engaged in all this. It's a quite elaborate story. We've detailed it in our broadcasts about World Trade Center and Uncensored History. It goes back to the relationship of Admiral William Crow, who was the admiral in the Joint Chiefs under Clinton, and then the ambassador to the UK, and the chairman of Bioport, involved in transferring anthrax and other such produced agents to Porton Downs in Great Britain, where they tested these on civilians, and just as the clouds of secrecy document similar such things in the United States. It's, you know, let me just mention one thing quickly, and then when we talk about these things, we're quickly accused of being involved in conspiracy theory. Interestingly enough, after all, I think Leon Trotsky once said that history is not operated or explained by conspiracy, but this tiny and secretive ruling class rules by such means.
With the first part, over an hour, by Ralph Schoenman, and then presentation by me, Maya Schoen, and then with almost an hour of questions and answers. You've heard the first question and part of the second question, and then there are many, many more in this almost an hour of Q&A. Please, and at the top, our gift to you for your generous donation to WBAI of $100. And all donations are appreciated, from the very small to whatever you can do, $500, $1,000, $1,500, $5,000, and even $10,000, anything, everything and everything, 212-209-2950 to sustain WBAI, your station. Russ?
We want to emphasize that the motive for the fundraising is to sustain this kind of information and broadcasting, and again to urge you to keep Free Speech Radio alive, remembering that Maya and I are unpaid producers. Most of the producers are unpaid producers. We do this out of political commitment, but the station depends on money to operate. It has staff who work laboriously and hard for small wages, engineers, technical help, the people who keep a station going on a day-to-day basis. They need your support. WBAI needs your support. Taking AIM needs your support.
And remember, we have only ourselves. We are the many, and they are the few. While President Bush accumulates coffers of $200 million, that's just the stated part of his presidential election campaign to steal the election, and if they don't do it through their television ads and their travel places and everything else, they're going to do it through the new touchscreen election equipment by manufacturers like Diebold, who has already made public that he's going to assure that President Bush gets reelected. So 212-209-2950. It is our contributions. We can do it. We are the many and they are the few. And we need a voice on the air to bring us news at 11:30 when Robert Knight comes on with the coverage from New Hampshire.
Yes, with the misleaders and their pranks and their carryings on. Let me mention, by the way, pay attention to Robert Knight's coverage, because you're going to be here, the fakers, as they lie their way across our airwaves, and it's only WBAI that is capable of puncturing their balloons and analyzing the empty rhetoric and what underlies it. Keep one other aspect in mind, may I mention, brothers and sisters?
And wait, Ralph, before you do, there's no better way to look at this election, this upcoming election, to understand the dynamics of this election than to have Treason at the Top, Treason at the Top, and to listen to it over and over again. 212-209-2950 to share it with your friends, your families, your colleagues. Some of our listeners write to us and tell us that when Taking AIM is on the air, they gather with their friends in their living room and then they have a discussion afterwards. And that's what you can do with Treason at the Top, too.
I'm proud to say we get calls and we get workers call in and they tell us that at the where they're working in parking lots, the radio is on and people gather around at work to listen to Taking AIM. They say, you never hear anything like this. We're increasingly receiving that kind of communication. It's a measure of the importance of WBAI. It's a measure of the importance of your support for this kind of programming. I'd like to mention, by the way, that the New York Times had disclosed that 84% of the American people reject both political parties. Now, that may seem anomalous, but consider the following, brothers and sisters. In a national election, about 50 or 49% of the eligible voters register to vote. And in a primary like we're having tonight in New Hampshire, the actual turnout is roughly about 18, 19, 20%, 22% of the registered voters. But the eligible electorate is double that of the registered voters. So really you're talking about a turnout of 9%, and you cut it between two or three, four candidates, these fakers are getting, actually the 9% has to be cut between two parties, because once again, this is the eligible electorate's percentage, not the registered voters' percentage. So these fakers are getting 1.5% and 2% of the vote. It's because most people look at these two parties and these various candidates and they say, there's nothing here for us. It's the same old, same old. No matter which one of them gets in, they lie, they're crooks, things get worse. That's why we need to build a political movement of our own. That's why we need to begin the process of building a party based on working people, on a mass of our population that can strike out on its own needs and its own interests, not the one big property party with two names. The bosses have two parties. We need one of our own. We need the programming and we need the information that enables us to build that movement that will accomplish this, brothers and sisters. Keep that in mind when you listen to the rhetoric of the fakers tonight in New Hampshire.
And that's why we prepared a special gift for you, Treason at the Top, an analysis of the dynamics of war and the assault on us here in the United States. 212-209-2950. We were only able to play a small portion of Treason at the Top tonight. You can have it in your home for $100, 212-209-2950. And I want to remind you that another gift that we've prepared for you, thanks to Mark Bilk and Pamela Summers, and that is our internet site, www.takingaim.info. That's .info. And we chose .info because that's what we provide. We provide extensive info. And on it, we have some articles that Ralph has written. And also, we have an archive of our programs, programs that would not be here were it not for WBAI. And like WBAI, we don't charge for you to listen to those programs. You can take it down, you can download them to your computers, or you can listen live online. And the reason we do that is because these programs are so packed full of information, and you may be at work, you may have missed it, you may want to tell someone else about the Taking AIM programs, and you may want to listen again and again. And that's what you're going to want to do with Treason at the Top. And I want to remind you once again, our program, Taking AIM, would not exist were it not for WBAI. It is WBAI, the people at WBAI, who took the risk of putting Taking AIM on the air. And it is because of you, our listeners, that Taking AIM stays on the air and has become a stalwart of WBAI. And to keep that happening and to keep the other programming happening, this is the moment where we have to give generously. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
We want to continue with the programming, and we want to continue with the mobilizing, and we want to continue with the struggle, brothers and sisters. Bear in mind that the crisis we face is not new, nor has the evil changed in our society. The victimization of the many, the exploitation of the most disadvantaged, and the brutal armed subjugation of peoples across the world has been a feature of capitalism for many, many generations. We are in that tradition of resistance and of struggle. We are not going to make a revolution like Nescafe, brothers and sisters. It's a process, but it's a process that requires truth being spoken to power, information that arms us. It is our means through which we equip ourselves to build the struggle, which will ultimately result in a transformation of this society through revolutionary change. For this is a system so degenerate, it is incapable of meeting, in any extended historical period, the most elementary needs of human beings, and of indeed life on this planet.
Well, I'd like to
cannot sustain itself.
To thank you, Ralph. Ralph Schoenman, Ralph and Maya Schoenman. This is Robert Knight.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, greetings.
Hi, this takes me back, 1982.
Oh, yes, we worked some stuff on Poland and the Lebanese invasion, as I recall,
yes,
as well.
Yes, that's right, Robert.
Well, it's good to be with you this way, and that we have both survived, such as we have, at least to this point in time.
Yes.
And congratulations on the successful drive tonight, hitting the way multiple kilobuck mark. And it's still coming in, and that's a very good sign, Ralph and Mike.
Thank you, Robert. I'm glad to hear that.
And we're waiting to hear your election coverage.
All right. Well,
we want to let everyone know first we'll be back next week, Tuesday. We're on from 5 to 6 p.m.
Well, Ralph and Maya Schoenman, who, with their program Taking Aim, suggest to us that perhaps one of the best places to hide an electoral conspiracy is among the media, the mechanics, and the moguls, but hopefully not the voters. Thank you, Ralph and Maya.
You're right.
Hi, Robert.